Hello, Alexis.
Hello. Good to be here.
Folks who were expecting to see Matt Lewis are either pleasantly surprised or greatly disturbed. But it's great to have a new face here on the DMZ. Can you tell folks more about yourself?
I am a senior political reporter at National Review. I used to work with Matt at the Daily Caller, which is how I swung this very cool gig. And I've been out on the campaign trail covering all the presidential, mostly the Republican presidential candidates for the past few months.
And it's Alexis Levinson. We should say that says it above your head. But just folks listening on the podcast know your full name, Alexis Levinson. They can find you at nationalreview.com now.
Yes, they can.
And so you're a reporter for the National Review, which is a conservative magazine. It does seem, I feel, in the past few years to be doing more reporting. I mean, it's known more mostly for opinion, obviously, but, you know, Robert Costa is now at the Washington Post, cut his teeth at the National Review, covering the ins and outs of the Republican congressional caucuses. Is that your lane now? Are you doing straight reporting for them, or are you bringing your own opinion to the mix?
Yeah, no, this is all straight reporting. I stay out of the opinion business. There are plenty of people with much more interesting opinions than I have. But I, you know, I came from Roll Call. They offered me a job covering presidential campaigns. I was not even about to refuse. That sounds too cool. So I'm having a great time.
I'm just curious. So what is the editorial direction then? Is it just you call it as you see it, or is there a certain angle that a conservative publication wants to take when covering Republican candidates?
You know, I think we just go for the most direction I've been given is make it interesting and tell readers something they don't know. Try and stay out of the Washington groupthink. So, for instance, I was in Atlanta last week when Eric Erickson decided Donald Trump was no longer invited because of the Megyn Kelly comments, and I assumed, and my editor agreed, the world did not need another "Is this the end of Donald Trump?" piece. So I didn't write that. But it's, you know, for the most part, I do what all these other reporters, you know, all the other reporters do. I'm on the campaign trail. I interview candidates. I talk to people. I know I'm writing for a conservative audience, and I try and keep that in mind when I write. I'm certainly not going out there and saying, oh, look at Hillary's new ad. That's probably a little less interesting for the people I write for. But for the most part, I do the same thing most other reporters do.
And what does the conservative audience want? Are they looking to you to help them sort out the differences between the candidates, or do you get a lot of people who are cheering for their candidate who get mad at you if you don't give them validation of what they already believe?
I would say it's less that. I started at National Review in June, but in my limited time there, I have found it's been a very not particularly insane audience, is I guess the right word. I don't get a lot of head-on-fire commenters being like, oh my god, you said something terrible about the guy I like. It's a little bit more intelligent, reasoned. That's not to say, you know, maybe people aren't having strong reactions to what I write, but I'm not getting a lot of screed in my email. So far I seem to be doing okay.
Now, you are literally just getting off of the plane from witnessing Donald Trump's latest campaign appearance in Michigan, which happened on Tuesday. You know, everyone watching the Trump spectacle keeps waiting for the wheels to come off. People thought that he had a terrible debate performance, and then he got tangled up with this war of words with Megyn Kelly. And there's some decline in his poll numbers, but he's still in front by and large. And from what I can tell, had a pretty boisterous rally in Michigan. Watching up close, do you get the sense that he just is going to continue to defy political gravity, or do you sense that there is some underlying concern in his campaign circles that this can't last forever?
You know, I am now very hesitant of making predictions about Donald Trump because we've all been proven so many times, like you said. I mean, he really does seem to be Teflon, and I, for the life of me, don't understand quite why. But this was the first time I sort of got a sense of why people like him at all, and kind of what is bringing so many people into his fold. And that's, I had a bunch of people just tell me, like, it's really, they really see him as the consummate not politician. And they feel like he makes these completely, I wrote a whole piece about this, he makes these like outlandish, brazen statements that no one else would ever get away with saying. So, you know, he gets up there, he's like, the Iran hostages, you know, I would have had them out in 2 minutes, guarantee it. And everyone starts applauding. And, you know, like, I cover politics for a living. At no point in my life am I sitting here thinking, oh, yeah, that's totally realistic. Donald Trump is going to go, like, punch the supreme leader of Iran in the face and we're going to have the hostages back. Sure, of course, this is how negotiations work. But people seem to believe him. And I think part of that from talking to people there is that they feel like all these politicians have had the chance to do it their way for so long, and that's, they seem to include pretty much everyone else in the field there, and they haven't made it work. And so, you know, the VA, I had some guy who was talking about the VA, he was like, the VA, I can call them, they still don't call me back. So Donald Trump, because he doesn't have a record, has not yet disappointed people. And so they're willing to kind of try something new in the hopes that maybe this time they won't be disappointed. If that makes sense.
Now, I they totally make sense, and it's not all that dissimilar from, you know, the initial support for Ross Perot when he got into the debates and said I don't have any experience running up a $4 trillion debt. People ate that stuff up. But I feel like in Washington conservative circles, there's a lot of, you know, begging of the conservative rank and file. Hey, this guy likes single payer. This guy once wanted to raise taxes on the wealthy. He was once pro-choice. This guy is not a bona fide conservative. You know, don't buy the snake oil. When you're out there in real America, as Sarah Palin would say, are these folks just not listening to those concerns from inside the Beltway conservatives?
You know, it's what was fascinating to me was just how much people didn't seem. He gets away with things that other politicians cannot for their life get away in. So, right, we live, politics right now on the Republican, you know, Republican primary voters, compromise is like this horrible, dirty word. And, you know, people are still mad at Chris Christie over hugging Obama. Like, this is, you're not supposed to be nice to the other side. And Donald Trump gets up there on that stage and he's like, you know, you gotta know the other guys. You gotta have a relationship. I used to have a great relationship with Chuck Schumer. Like, and I have a relationship with the other guys, and that's super important because you got to be able to make deals. You got to be able to compromise. And somehow, he doesn't use the word compromise. He says make deals. And somehow that seems to resonate in a totally different way. Whereas, you know, I've been to Ted Cruz events where Ted Cruz gets out there and he's like, you know, when they say compromise, they don't mean compromise. They mean, you know, capitulate. And everyone's totally on board with that too. And so it's, he just, like, they don't, he seems to have different rules for every single thing he does.
He seems to give the perception that a Donald Trump deal means I get everything I want and the other side gets nothing. You know, I'm going to build a wall, make Mexico pay for it. That's my deal.
Right. And Mexico's going to pay for it happily. Not just pay for it. They're going to be delighted to do so.
But that's sort of part, I mean, I would think he gets away with it because you only have to respond to the pushback if the voters are demanding you respond to the pushback. If he has a legion of, you know, 20% or so of the Republican primary electorate who is not interested in the pushback,
right,
then you can glide past the criticisms and no one and remain in the front runner seat because no one else is able to get up to 20%.
Yeah, no, and I mean, really, people don't seem to quite mind. And I mean, I talked to the guy who made this whole thing, comment about we trust him because he hasn't let us down yet, was wearing a Veteran for Donald Trump shirt. And I asked him, I was like, what did you think of the John McCain comments? And he said, well, I felt like those were pretty specifically a dig at John McCain, and we all say things we don't mean sometimes. And, like, that, I mean, that is more benefit of the doubt than I think I've ever heard a politician getting. Politicians say things, they get turned into ads, and that's it. You know, this will happen to Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush will say, I don't think we need to spend that much money on women's health. That's going to be an ad. That's, you know, and he's going to be stuck with that. Or, you know, the reason those things work is because people don't give voters the benefit, or people don't give politicians the benefit of the doubt.
Well, so the other problem is in that there Trump has made it that you will pay a price if you criticize him directly. He will either mock you mercilessly, as he did with Scott Walker and Lindsey Graham and Jeb Bush. And then he has his ultimate threat, lording over everybody. If you don't treat me fairly, I'm going to go third party and blow up everything.
Right. Up everything. I mean, that would be a huge problem for Republicans.
Well, you know, I had a piece up in Real Clear Politics last week. I don't think Matt and I batted around at all. I think I only mentioned it in passing. I actually made the case that Trump would not throw the race to the Democrats. He would not solely draw from conservative Republicans. He would be more like Ross Perot, who at the end of the day drew evenly from Democrats and Republicans, because once he got to a general election, right now he's talking about immigration because that's what animates the Republican base, but he also believes in investing in infrastructure. His stance on trade has Democratic appeal. He has supported wealth taxes before. Maybe he'd bring that stuff back if he was running in a general election. There are ways he could be more ideologically heterodox if the votes he needs to attract are different than when that would be the case in a general. So if I was, you know, Reince Priebus, I might say to myself, what's hurting me more, Trump being the face of my party now or having him go nuts in a general and maybe probably will just implode altogether and not even get to double digits. But even if he did, he'd probably pick off some anti-TPP Democrats who won't be happy with Hillary Clinton, and it might all be a wash.
I think that's fair. I do think he seems to have tapped into something that seems specific to Republicans, and part of that is the immigration stuff. I think you'd be hard-pressed to have Donald Trump picking up a lot of Democratic votes when someone's running on loop all these immigration comments. I think that, you know, I mean, if a Democrat's smart and Donald Trump's suddenly the third party in the race, they just put the, we're going to build a wall, Mexicans are rapists, blah, 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 comments on loop. And all of a sudden I think he kind of drops down, but also probably specifically pulls from Republicans. But I don't know.
What's sort of the question? How more multicultural is the Democratic Party now than 20 years ago? There used to be more tension between, you know, the union part of the Democratic Party and the pro-immigrant part of the Democratic Party. Those divisions have been largely healed, certainly. And as the number of the Latino voters increases, they become a more important part of the coalition. Unions have made their peace with that. They want those Latino folks in unions, so they don't want to fight with them as much anymore. But, you know, it only takes a couple million to, you know, if you get a handful of Democrats who are anti-trade but also think immigrants depress wages, you get a handful of those guys in, say Ohio or Iowa or Colorado, it wouldn't take that much for it to even out what he might get on the Republican side.
Yeah, I mean, I think mostly my problem here is I've stopped being comfortable making any kind of prediction about Donald Trump, because every time I've been completely wrong. I really thought the McCain war hero comments were going to be the end.
Right.
That to me seemed, for given how strongly Republicans react when you insult veterans, I mean, it took, like, Mark Pryor, the former senator from Arkansas, that was the ad that was like, I don't know, it was the South, it was a wave election year. There were a lot of other things going on, but like the outrage when he suggested that Tom Cotton was thinking he was entitled to a Senate seat because he'd gone to war was just, I mean, like, and none of that happened with Trump. Or like some of it happened, but it happened on such a lesser scale. And that was really surprising to me. So the Mengele stuff happened and I was like, well, I guess we don't know.
So I appreciate you don't want to make predictions because predictions are generally useless. But do you have a sense that there's still a sense, I think, that there's a ceiling on Trump? He might be holding on to his 20, but he can't get to 30 or 40 being this way. And it only looks relatively good now because no one else has caught fire. But someone down the line presumably can crack 20%, and then it's all over for Trump. Do you have that sense that Trump is just going to stay at this level, or is there something deeper afoot that would actually make the Trump juggernaut be truly unstoppable?
No, I agree. I think I think the wheels come off at some point. I don't quite know how. My best guess is that if he's still around and at this level by the time the Iowa caucuses roll around, and the New Hampshire caucuses, he just doesn't do as well as everyone, as the polls were saying. I think he's putting a lot of stock in these national polls and state polls being like, oh, you've got 25%. But I also think, you know, there are a lot of people who a pollster will call and they'll say, yeah, I'll totally vote for Donald Trump. That sounds awesome. Who would get into a voting booth and think, wait a minute, maybe I'd rather vote for like Jeb Bush or someone, you know, like I am now actually voting for the president, potential next president of the United States, as opposed to, you know, who I think would be fun to tell a pollster. So I think there's a little bit of that. I also think, you know, his name is out there a lot more. Everyone else is starting to run ads. Like, give it a couple months. You know, no one in Iowa is going to be able to turn on the TV without seeing wall-to-wall political ads, especially this cycle. And I think that might start.
I mean, Trump hasn't even run an ad yet. That's one of the amazing things. He's put almost no money into the campaign.
Yeah. I'm not sure he needs to. who doesn't know who Donald Trump is? But also, the other thing, and Dave Weigel actually pointed this out when we were at this Trump event last night. There was no, at least there didn't seem to be any ground game of any kind. I mean, there was no one taking names, you know, for an email list. There was no one holding signs to stand up against the protesters who, by the way, had hilarious songs like We Shall Overcome, which I thought was pretty great. But, you know, there was no organization, and it's not clear that he has any of that yet. And that, especially with a caucus, that starts to become a thing because people don't just show up.
This was Newt Gingrich's problem.
Themselves.
He would get good media hits. He would attack a debate moderator and get a spike in the polls. But when it came down to having a ground game, he put no effort into that. And on election day, it showed. Well, Rick Perry, Rick Perry's having a hard time paying staff right now. You know, Matt's wife works for Perry, so we can't talk smack about Perry when he's around. Now we can. Perry, I would think, probably has some staff, right?
He was plenty of staff.
He'd been around the block. So if he actually, if he said, I can't pay my staff anymore, I got to fold up shop, could Trump, you know, there could be potential overlap between a Perry supporter and a Trump supporter, perhaps.
You know, I guess if you're really desperate to be making money, it's not the worst thing. My sense of people who go work for Trump or mostly of people who have been offered jobs for Trump is that they are offered obscene sums of money if they will start immediately and go work on his campaign. You know, I've heard stories of people being like totally wooed in the airplane and I don't know. But no, there's a reason a lot of those people didn't jump at it. And I think part of that is there's concern about the reputation. Because clearly, you know, the statement Donald Trump put out when he got disinvited from Red State was Eric Erickson is a total loser. Only deviant minds would think that, you know, I was making any reference to menstruation. Like, it was not the kind of statement that your communications flack sat there and said, all right, Mr. Trump, like, let's craft a statement, you know, that makes you come out looking stronger. This was clearly, like, Donald Trump was like, throw the wall, you know, throw it all at them. Let's, like, make them squirm. And if you're, you know, that's one thing. If you're someone who has worked for him for a very long time and your professional career is kind of working for Donald Trump, the businessman, that's another thing if you're coming from an actual political background and you know for your next job you're going to have to be going in and they're going to say, okay, well, why did you let him call someone a loser in a press release? And you're like, well, because I had no control in this situation. And it's like, well, why didn't you have control? And so I think, you know, there's clearly some concern and probably justified concern about what this means for your professional life moving forward.
Now, if Trump survived the first debate without losing his frontrunner position, it might have taken a little bit of water. It seems that the other winner out of the debate wasn't even in the main debate. It was Carly Fiorina who was in the kids table debate, which, you know, only a quarter of the main audience even watched. They got about 6 million people watching. But she got a fair amount of good headlines coming out of that debate. I mean, people saw some clips looped on cable news. And now you're seeing some polling where, you know, she was at 1% before. And now she's more like 8 or 9 in a handful of national and state polls, which in this race is gangbusters.
Huge.
But you know, both Trump and Herbie, these are, you know, two of the three people in the race who have never held a political job. The third being Ben Carson, who also polls pretty well.
People love Ben Carson.
That's even a bigger mystery to me. But I mean, Trump at least sort of has his calling card that he is wildly successful. I'm the smartest guy. I have billions of dollars. Look at my financial statement. I'm huge. Carly Fiorina is someone who got fired from being a CEO, lost her only political race that she ran. How is she breaking out of the pack here?
I think it's partly just because she is someone who can stand up and speak for an extended period of time. And I've only seen her once do something that she had to walk back. And it was something pretty minor. She, in her red state speech, got asked about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and responded to the question as if she were being asked about the Department of Commerce, like it was a government agency. That's the biggest mistake I've seen her make. And admittedly, she hasn't had the spotlight shined on her, but it's kind of a big deal in the Republican Party for someone to be able to speak for that long and never have to walk back a statement, I think, and never have to say, oh, shoot, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to say that. People like that about her. I get texts from people who are backing other candidates who turn around and they're like, man, she's really good. She's just really, really good. I really like her. Don't tell anybody. And people seem to really respond well to the way she's attacking Hillary, what she's saying, the way she's saying it. People really like her. I think this is her moment.
I mean, she clearly is well practiced on television. I believe she actually has a background in marketing before, as part of her rise to being a CEO. But I mean, does anybody that you talk to pause and say, "We need someone who's actually held elective office before"? Or is this the disgust? There's this twin disgust? I'm so mad at the Democrats and Barack Obama that we picked this community organizer and he's run the country to the ground. And I'm mad at the Republican establishment. They're a bunch of numbnuts. They don't know what they're doing. We need someone who's going to wipe this slate clean, and someone who's had the least amount of interaction with the federal government is the person that I want. So therefore, I'm going to go with either Trump or Fiorina or Carson. That just seems like fun for a while. But are there any cooler heads that are going to prevail here?
So I would separate Carson and Fiorina because I think the Carson thing is kind of a unique situation. But I mean, clearly people seem very enthused at the idea of having a non-politician. I do hear a lot of people say, well, man, she's really got to be on the ticket somehow. I'm not necessarily sure people are sold yet that she should be the nominee as opposed to the vice president or some cabinet position. I really think it's just they haven't heard of her. They see her and they're like, man, she's good. And she can attack Hillary there seems to be some probably justified concern that a Republican man is going to get up there and try and attack Hillary and something horrific is going to come out that, you know, they're going to have to be dealing with for the next however many months. She doesn't have that problem. She doesn't sell herself that way as the only woman candidate, but she is. I think
that's implied. I feel there's subtle things that she does.
She says it, but she doesn't. It's not like her be all end all. I'm the only woman, you should elect me. But I think that debate performance put her on people's radar. And I think I actually think the timing with the Donald Trump stuff and the Megyn Kelly thing is depending how she capitalizes it on it. I think this could be her moment. She could be the one who's like, look, I'm the adult in the room. I'm the only woman. You want to talk about this? Like, let me be the adult who can actually talk about this in a coherent way. Let me attack Donald Trump from a position that none of you men on this stage can attack him from. And I'm going to seize this. And this is going to be my thing. And she hasn't yet, but I think that could be coming.
Well, certainly it could be her moment if these poll numbers hold and she actually gets into the CNN debate next month, then it'll be the sort of first example. You actually can graduate from the kids table to the big event.
She's not the one we expected to do that either.
Right, right.
Everyone sort of expected that would be Rick Perry.
I mean, Perry was sort of the one on the bubble.
Staff. Yeah. Right.
If that happened, I would imagine there'd be a lot of spotlight on her as the new one on stage, and people would want to see how she handles the crowd. Now you say Carson is different. Then, so he's not a business person the way Trump and Fiorina are. I felt that, you know, Herman Cain in 2012, you know, who was, you know, pretty low rent CEO, Godfather's Pizza, got as far as he did just because on a sense that we need to have an African American guy against Barack Obama, and he's the one who's on the stage. That is less of a situation now because there is no African American candidate on the Democratic side. I don't necessarily feel that is what's driving the Carson love. From an outsider, it almost seems kind of zen-like, almost sort of crypto-religious. He has this very sort of calm, soothing demeanor that seems to be completely detached from, you know, the hurly-burly swirling around him. Is there a religious aspect to, I mean, he tends to be around 10%, that tends to not move around very much. Is that the basis of it, or is there something else going on that I can't understand?
So, I Carson is difficult. Like you said, he's this very calm, mild-mannered person. There's no outrage, which seems to be what people like, and somehow we're rewriting the rules in this election. Everyone likes outrage except Ben Carson is super calm, and everyone loves Ben Carson. I was really surprised. He got super high marks for that debate performance, which I thought was very unexciting. But I think part of it, he has a fan base. He has a fan base, and I saw this, I went on the campaign trail with him. He wrote these books, and when people come up to him at town halls, and say, well, what's your position on global warming or whatever? And he'll say, well, it's laid out in the book. And they'll say, not, oh, I should go get the book. They say, oh, which book? The first one or the last one? Because they've read his books. And so he's working from a fan base that has, I think a lot of the people who are supporting him have taken the time to get to know him already. And so they know about his positions. They know about his story, which is, I mean, undeniably a fantastic story. I don't know that it necessarily qualifies you to be president, but I mean, guys, hugely impressive. It's, you know, it's hard not to sort of stand in awe of the top neurosurgeon basically in the world. And I think people just respond to that. I don't think the comparison between Herman Cain is quite fair. I think Herman Cain was almost more of a Donald Trump figure, in that he was very loud and very exciting and charismatic and said some totally bizarre things that we were like, oh, this is fun, let's cover this. I think Ben Carson is sort of oddly his own phenomenon. But because I think the people who like him have taken the time to get to know him, I'm not sure how much room there is for growth. I don't think anyone ever stops liking him. I just don't know that he convinces a lot of other people he should be running the country.
Now, I know you largely cover the Republican candidates, but we do now have a Democratic candidate who also completely lacks elective governmental experience in the name of Lawrence Lessig, who is a Harvard law professor. He has been a democracy activist. He's advocate for net neutrality. He's been pushing. He ran the Mayday PAC, which was designed to be the super PAC to end super PACs and get money out of politics. But the races that Mayday PAC backed, they all lost. So now he's trying a new gimmick where he puts himself out as the referendum candidate. He's a stand-in essentially for this package of election reforms, which he promises if he wins, he would do nothing but enact those reforms. And then once they were done, he would quit. And whoever was vice president would become president. He probably had some back and forth with the Sanders campaign, because you know Bernie Sanders wants to get money out of politics. He wants to overturn Citizens United. But Lessig felt that Bernie wasn't prioritizing the issue in a way that he thinks needs to be prioritized. It should be first and foremost, everything else is secondary. And so when Bernie didn't follow his advice, he went off in his own direction. So I should have a piece coming out in Politico soon talking about how this is sort of the latest example of, you know, Bernie being, you know, taken, criticized from all sides within the left, instead of him being able to put more pressure on Hillary to move Hillary leftward, the left is putting pressure on Bernie to be more pure or be more perfect in their strategic prioritization, whether it's Black Lives Matter or some of the immigration folks and now Lessig. But Lessig says, all I need is to get 1% in the polls, get into the debate, you know, sort of like with Fiorina, although the bar is a little bit lower for Democrats because there's fewer candidates, and then try to make this the issue of the race. I am very skeptical that Lessig's, I mean, he might get into the debates, but I don't think he's going to get people to believe we should be single issue and nothing else. But if he takes a chunk out of Bernie, that makes it harder for Bernie, both in his own campaign and in vis-a-vis pressuring Hillary. I don't know if you have any, since you don't track the Democrats as closely, if you have any thoughts about that.
I think Larry Lessig is someone that reporters will really enjoy writing about for a while, and it will be about as effective as you were talking about May Day PAC, which I covered a lot because I was covering House and Senate races for Roll Call last cycle. It'll be about as effective as May Day PAC was, which was completely useless. It's just, I respect people who feel so strongly about a particular issue, but I'm not entirely sure that this is your way to get the conversation out there. This is the guy who landed, who flew the little gyrocopter to and landed on the Capitol lawn and is now arrested. He was also trying to deal with money in politics. And, you know, I feel like I talked about him a lot more than I talked about Larry Lessig.
Well, there seems to be this sense that there's a faction on the left that believes, one, if you don't deal with, you know, campaign finance, all is lost. The democracy has been bought and sold, and we can't get anything accomplished, which I think is just factually wrong. There's plenty of things that have been done on Obama's watch that are good for the advancement of liberalism. They may not be perfect or have made everything magical instantaneously, but I think you're hard-pressed to say that sort of we've been running in place. You have Obamacare, you have Dodd-Frank, you have the new EPA regulations, there's new HUD housing desegregation regulations that haven't been talked about much at all, but are pretty significant. They repealed the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. There's a whole bunch of things that have been done, despite the fact that there's money in politics. So I find it sort of ludicrous to say you should shelve all your other work and focus on this one thing. I mean, let's say Lessig was president. You still have a Republican House. So how long is Lessig going to have to hang around?
Right.
To focus on his one thing while, Russia just invaded Poland. What are you going to do about that, buddy? You know, things are going to happen on your watch that are not election reform, and he's going to have to deal with that. So I think I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I mean, I'm just like, I agree, you know, I'm a reporter. My interest in this is it's far more interesting if people are spending boatloads of money to elect someone. I don't really have any, feelings on the subject beyond that, but the one thing I would say is it's really hard to have this conversation in an election where you're not going to get elected without that much money. So, like, it's all even, I don't think he's trying to get elected president. I think he's trying to insert the issue, like you said. But if he gets on the debate stage and starts talking about, we should get money out of politics, it's a pretty easy fix for Hillary Clinton to turn around and be like, yeah, and what should I do with Jeb's $100 million?
Well, Lessig does say...
Do you want a Democrat elected
Lessig
at all?
Lessig does say he will raise big money. He was criticizing Bernie, because Bernie won't. Bernie won't have a super PAC. He wants to be totally
right.
Pure. And Lessig is saying, no, you got to play by the rules as they are so we can end the rules. I mean, that was the May Day PAC philosophy. So I give Lessig some credit there for political realism. I think he will try to raise the money, but I think it's going to be hard to raise the money when you're single issue, because you're now greatly limiting the pool of people that you can attract. Hillary is going to say, look, I want to overturn Citizens United too. I'm for a constitutional amendment. I would pick judges that would reject the court's current reasoning, but I'm going to go toe-to-toe with Jeb, and I'm going to be able to handle all these other issues that you guys aren't talking about. And Lessig is trying to say that Bernie's economic critique, he said this to Bloomberg recently, I agree with what Bernie says about the economy, but that is not as popular across the board in the country as my plan for election reform is. And gyrocopter guys are along the same lines. I think there's a bit of a delusion that everybody agrees about our particular policy solution to the problem of money in politics. People might not like money in politics, but one of the things that Lessig wants is a campaign finance public matching system where if you donate money to a candidate, it's a tax write-off for you. but and there's this huge pool of public money that uses to do like a super match, like six times what you donate. There's lots of people that don't like that. Many conservatives don't want to see taxpayer money used for campaigns. It's not a controversial subject. Not saying I disagree with it, but to assume that like Lessig is sort of with the people, and when Bernie talks about income inequality, he's talking to a smaller pool of people. That's just flat out assumption. There's just no empirical evidence that that's true. And at the end of the day, there's a whole bunch of issues out there that if they were easy, they'd be done by now. You have to fight for them. You have to organize around them. And you can't assume that just by one election, they get done in a matter of days. And now Lessig is out there saying, well, if through my plan, we'll have this huge public uprising over this one subject that we'll be able to ram everything through Congress, which I think is just totally, you know, fantastical.
Yeah. I mean, so not to change the subject, but I think we may have given Lessig a little bit more oxygen than he needs.
That's right.
The one thing I think with Bernie is I feel really bad for Bernie because I feel like Bernie has become sort of the receptacle for every single disappointment with Hillary, that people seem to expect him to fill every single niche progressive want and need that they don't necessarily think she's feeling. And so he's somehow getting attacked even more, it seems like, than she is for not, you know, he's the one who's getting interrupted by Black Lives Matter protesters.
Well, this is the premise of the piece I'm coming at Politico, I believe shortly, where, you know, he's now the punching bag for the left. He's supposed to be, you know, the progressive, and he's now stuck in this position where, you know, once you put yourself out to be the ideological standard bearer, well, everyone wants you to adhere to their specific standards. So, you know, he's not being asked by Black Lives Matter, what's your plan for ending systemic racism? Well, that's a centuries-old problem that nobody has a good answer for. So that's a pretty hard bar to clear.
Well, Donald Trump has an answer to that, and that is esprit de corps and cheerleading.
I stand corrected.
His answer to racial tensions is jobs and spirit. And esprit de corps. That's a quote.
You know, so, and Bernie, you know, as a movement candidate, you know, he doesn't have a bunch of security goons running his campaign event. So he gets up on stage. It's a free for all. Anyone who wants to bum rush the mic gets to bum rush the mic and to disrupt the event. When Black Lives Matter tried to disrupt the Hillary event, they for some reason decided to tell the New Republic first. So the New Republic puts it on their website. The Hillary campaign reads it. All of a sudden, it turns out that Hillary's inside the building and Secret Service says no one else can enter right now. Oh, sorry, guys. Kitch can't come in. Kitch can't disrupt the show. And nobody gets as mad at Hillary about that because there's just a different expectation of how an establishment candidate operates and a movement candidate operates. Bernie is expected to be the perfect progressive. And so anyone who thinks that a perfect progressive should do X, Y, or Z, and he does not do that, he's now fallen. And Hillary, more recently, you know, she certainly has had a degree of pressure on her from the left, but recently she said, you know, Glass-Steagall is not the end-all be-all of Wall Street reform. And I'm not going to tell you what my position on Keystone Pipeline is. You got to wait till I'm president to find that out. She feels a little freer to do that sort of thing. And as I suggest in the piece, it might have been better for the left to not have a primary challenge, because in the run-up to Hillary's announcement, the threat of Elizabeth Warren was more impactful than the actuality of a primary challenge that Sanders has to navigate all the different currents and strands of the progressive movement. Just the fear of what Warren might do. Maybe she'll run. Maybe she'll publicly scold me if I don't do X, Y, or Z. Maybe she'll put out her own plan and force me to have to match her plan. That seemed to move Hillary off the dime as far as her rhetorical approach is concerned and what issues she decided to prioritize. It's never going to be exactly what the populist left wants, but certainly she's running differently than Bill did in 1992. And I question whether it made sense to try to raise the stakes with Bernie's own challenge, because that leads to a whole bunch of other complications that are hard to navigate.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think part of the reason she can get away with anything is because she's probably going to be the nominee. And, like, at a certain point, I don't know. I agree. Bernie's become the punching bag, and I feel a little bad about that. Like, I like Bernie Sanders. I like his hair. It's a very we are all better for Bernie Sanders being in this race. Not quite as good as we are for Lincoln Chafee being in this race, but pretty good.
Well, hey, Fiorina got her moment. Chafee could have his. Don't care.
Yeah, about I don't know. The metric system, it's coming back, guys.
Well, I think the Sanders supporters. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, the Lincoln Chafee, when he came out with the metric system, I was ready to throw it all out and go help run his campaign, help him find his Facebook password. Like, I was ready to go.
There should be a metric ruler on the right sidebar of his website. He should go all in on metric. It was just a one.
He really should. Yeah, you're going to do it. Go all out. Sorry, you were saying about Sanders.
I mean, the Sanders supporters are beside themselves because, you know, again, you know, Bernie has a long track record in the progressive movement. You know, what's sort of exciting about it is let's see what Bernie can do. He's been honing this economic pitch for decades. Let's put it on the road. Let's see how it plays outside of Vermont. Let's see how far we can take it and where this all leads us. And now there's all this pressure on him to not do that, that the economic critique is insufficient to deal with racism and to deal with money in politics. So you got to incorporate all these other things into your stuff now. And, you know, it's hard for any presidential campaign to do everything. You have to balance things. You have to be some sort of, you know, some level of issue prioritization, some sort of overarching theme. And if you try to make every constituency give the maximum happiness, I mean, it's an impossible game. You can't win that. And so the diehard Sanders folks are, I think, a little disgruntled because they're not seeing Bernie get to be the full Bernie, and that's what they wanted to see him do, and now he's being bogged down.
So my favorite, not to totally change the subject, but since we're talking about single issues and prioritization, my favorite answer on campaign finance reform. Someone asked John Kasich about it at a town hall a couple weeks ago, maybe a week ago, losing track. And he's like, well, I don't really like the system we have, but, you know, I don't really know how I would replace it. And frankly, it's just not really a high priority for me. So I don't know. And, like, you know, all of us reporters walked out of that. We really like that answer. Like, you don't know. Like, give it to us straight. That was,
Is there any pro-Kasich love out there? I mean, you got some reviews from the debate, but there's a general sense that he expanded Medicaid through Obamacare, therefore that's a dead letter amongst Republican voters. Is that fair?
I don't know. I have big hopes, or not big hopes, big predictions for Kasich in New Hampshire. I think he's going to be it. He picked up a really big deal endorsement last night from Tom Rath, who is a former New Hampshire AG, but he was a George W. Bush guy. And he's kind of an elder statesman up there, and he endorsed Kasich. And, you know, last time I'd been talking to him, he's like, I don't know, I'm hanging out with my grandson this summer. I don't want to get into this yet. And he's all of a sudden on Team Kasich. And so that's telling that when someone like that gets on board, that means people are looking at your campaign and saying, man, this guy has wheels. And so, you know, I think if he can pull off a big thing in New Hampshire, I think he becomes a player. I think anyone who does better than expected in the early primaries will be a player, but he looks like he could be in contention for maybe even first place in New Hampshire.
I mean, that would be the obvious thing for him to make a play with that of the early three, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, that is the most moderate-ish of your Republican electorates. And Kasich is certainly trying to, people say John Huntsman had no chance in 2012 and he didn't, but he still got double digits in New Hampshire. He wasn't nowhere. In fairness,
I don't think Kasich is John Huntsman. He does, like, obviously there are a lot of obvious comparisons. He has a lot of John Huntsman's team working for him. But I think Kasich is a much more well-positioned guy. And partly because John Huntsman was a super conservative governor of Utah. Like, super, super conservative. And all of a sudden, he's like, I'm the moderate guy, and I'm going to proclaim loud and proud that I'm the moderate guy. Kasich is not trying to be anything he's not, as from what I've seen. And also, like, for all, you know, I know Republicans have a huge beef with him, but he's the only governor running who has a really high approval rating in his home state. I mean, if Kasich is still in the race by Ohio, he gets Ohio's winner take all in the primary. He gets all of it. And that's a big deal because it's the same day as Florida. So Rubio and Jeb duke it out for Florida. And if Kasich's still there, Ohio's off the table as well. Because he's got a 60-something percent approval rating, which is, I mean, all these other governors in the race are, like, way, way below that. It's a large part of their state that hates them.
I think
he's interesting.
I want to...
He'll either flame out or he'll do really well.
I want to give you a chance to make news with John Kasich. This is the question that someone should pose if you get a chance to talk to him face to face. He has said on multiple occasions when talking about in defending his Medicaid expansion that he has too many prisoners in Ohio who are mentally ill, and he specifically talks about schizophrenics and that schizophrenics shouldn't be locked up in jail. They need treatment. And with the Medicaid funding that he has the means to treat them and keep them out of jail and let them allow them to lead normal, stable lives. You have the Holmes case in Colorado, where the Aurora shooter was convicted. But he wasn't given the death penalty, but he's going to get life without parole, even though the medical professionals that testified who said, we deem him to be clinically sane, but we're also telling you that he's schizophrenic. He's just schizophrenic, but he can tell right from wrong. I would like to see Kasich have to answer, should James Holmes be in prison or not?
I think that's an interesting question. Having said that, my guess is he'd sort of just be like, oh, that's apples and oranges.
Right.
That's not the same at all. Part of the problem with these guys is no one really answers a question they don't want to answer. No, if you're good, you're sticking around this long because you know how to not say anything that you really shouldn't say. Even if, you know. So,
we'll see.
I don't know. But I think he's one to watch is my two cents.
Well, I think we should leave it on that note. Where can folks find your work?
You can find it at nationalreview.com or on my Twitter feed, which is @Alexis_Levinson.
And where are you off to next?
I fly to Nevada tomorrow afternoon. I'm going to the Attorney General of Nevada, Adam Laxalt, who comes from a long dynasty of big deal politicians in Nevada, is holding a cattle call for 5 of the GOP presidential hopefuls. So I'm going to check that
Excellent.
Out.
Excellent. We
in brothel country.
We await your dispatch anxiously, and hope next time Matt is out of town, we can get you back here on the DMZ.
That'd be awesome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.